Welcome to the Informed Pregnancy and Parenting Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Elliot Berlin, and you have tuned into a great episode. I'm going to start by introducing my co-host for tonight. She's a wife, mother, birth worker, and artist. She's a doula, Reiki practitioner, yoga instructor, hypnobirthing childbirth educator, and studies herbalism. She's the queen of steam, making and selling vaginal steam stools and steaming blends. Nicole Sessions, welcome back.
Hey, hey.
And our guests tonight are husband and wife and parents-to-be. Each of them is very accomplished in diverse areas, and my research on them for this episode made me both fascinated and curious to learn more. I'm excited to take our listeners along for the ride. Briefly, she is a media personality, tattoo artist, model, entrepreneur, musician, author, art collector, and now a very stylish incubator. Kat Von D, welcome to the podcast.
I've never been called an incubator before.
I know.
I like it.
You heard it here first. He is a musician, author, painter, sculptor, and seems like he's just warming up. Rafael Reyes, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Dr. Berlin.
It's really great to have you guys.
Oh, it's great to be here.
I had the pleasure of meeting you both and starting to get to know you about a month ago. And before that, I didn't really know anything about either of you. But one thing I can say for sure is that when you're both in the room together, including right now, the love and passion is palpable. It's not, it fills the whole space. You know what I mean? It's not that PDA over the top, gooey, affectionate, like physical stuff. It feels a lot deeper than that. And it's really beautiful to be around.
Thank you.
And it's made me aim for that in my own relationship.
So, that makes me so happy.
So thank you. I want to spend the first segment learning more about you guys and your interesting backgrounds and how you got to where you are today. And then the second part, learning more about your pregnancy and your plans for childbirth and parenthood. So, Kat, I'll start with you.
Sure.
Back at the beginning, you were born in Mexico.
Yep.
But Von Drachenberg isn't the most Latina-sounding name.
Yeah, so my mom and dad are both from Argentina, and my dad was a missionary for the church. And so he traveled to Mexico and was building clinics in places where there was absolutely no clinics. And so that's how the three of us, my brother, sister, and I, were born in Mexico. So he comes from a German background, so von Drachenberg, which means dragon of the mountain. There's a castle outside of Cologne still that's a museum now, and overlooking the river that I still have yet to see. My grandmother I've seen a slide of her standing in front of it. But I just always say I'm a mixed up Latina because that's really what I am. Because in Mexico, people are like, oh, you have an accent. In Argentina, people say, oh, you have an accent.
So, but here you don't really have an accent.
Yeah, I don't have a Valley girl accent, right?
No, not at all. Did you grow up in the Valley?
No, I don't know why. No. I feel like if you're like talking about American accents, it's usually like cowboy or Valley girl, right?
So it's true. They're very palpable. South, the Southern.
Yeah, yeah.
When did you leave Mexico?
We moved here to America in 1988. So I was 6 years old.
Oh,
really? Or five or so.
Do you remember the first 5 years or something?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, Mexico was some of my favorite times of my life. I mean, they were just so simple. You know, we lived like on dirt floors that were like packed with water. Like that was, you know, my childhood pictures are me bathing in a bucket. You know, we didn't have running water and stuff. And that's what happens when you're going to a third world place where, you know, you're you know, doing missionary work, you know, as my dad was. It's like you're not going to places that are posh and nice and, you know, beautiful. But I just remember those were the times where my family was the closest. You know, it was just so simple. And, you know, I remember being a tomboy and like packing frogs into my pockets and them coming out like in the dinner table and stuff like that.
I love that.
Yeah.
They were Seventh-day Adventists.
Yeah. So my family, well, we were all brought up Seventh-day Adventist. I don't consider myself SDA or anything at all, but...
No.
No, yeah.
So SDA, I mean, a lot of people don't really even know what it is. To me, it just seems like almost Jewish with a lot less food.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, so it's still like a Christian-based religion, but it has like a lot of Jewish traits. So we kept the Sabbath growing up, and like none of my friends knew what that was. And we were I never was able to, you know, go to like slumber parties and stuff like that. Like, whoa! But not that we had that many friends. But yeah, so, and we know we didn't eat like any fish without scales, like,
kosher rules.
Yeah. Yeah. So I've never had like shrimp or lobster my whole life. Like, yeah,
wow.
I've never eaten that. Yeah.
Well,
and I'm vegan now, so I'm like, that's cool.
It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
I've never eaten it either. And I remember when we were dissecting basically seafood in high school biology, like the lobster, one of the kids was like, oh, that lobster tail looks delicious.
Oh.
I'm like, oh, that looks terrible.
Oh,
I guess if you haven't had it, you don't know.
So you know, it was quite a strict upbringing. So needless to say, I probably, you know, put my parents through the ringer, like, just through all the things I've been into over, you know, when they're quite conservative. So having a mohawk when you're 14. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I would say my parents are much more open now because they've dealt with me for the last 36 years. Yeah. But yeah, I think, my parents are amazing. They're just, you know, they're not Americanized in a lot of ways. And I think that that's one of the things I love about our childhood and, you know, the way we were brought up. You know, I had no idea who New Kids on the Block were when we first moved to America. That was like the band.
Yeah.
And I remember.
You were the New Kids on the Block.
Yeah. But I remember going to school and like seeing kids like wearing little buttons with like Jordan or whoever, Johnny, you know. And my sister and I, we were like, learning English, we didn't really care. So nothing like what people were wearing, like any material things, we just weren't interested in. You know, I was always drawing and, you know, we were always playing with each other and, you know, exercising our imagination versus like we couldn't afford television. So, you know, like cable or whatever. So I didn't know what MTV was or any of that stuff. And I love that. You know, I think I had like, I don't know, what's the American term for like, I was ahead of other people in that sense, you know, because we weren't bogged down by all the stuff that I think kids are nowadays.
Oh, even worse now.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Materialism and the media.
Yeah, yeah.
The media is you. Like, yeah. You can't even separate the kids from the media.
Yeah.
But you're very into the arts.
Yeah.
Right? Music and art collection and reading, and you became an author and a singer. And you play piano. Just, we have a little piano in the studio, and you pulled up to it and just hammered out some keys.
Thanks.
Where did you pick that up?
Well, I was classically trained since I was about five years old is when we started.
So when you moved here to California?
Yeah. So my grandmother, who was a pianist, she was like a real pianist.
Your Drachenberg grandmother?
Yeah, my dad's side.
Okay.
Yeah. And so she was like the cold German woman. So like, like they weren't cute, like fun, like piano lessons. It was like, you know, I've definitely felt like shamed at some points if I didn't get it right. But funny enough, my brother and sister never didn't really stick to it. And for me, I just obsessively like just grew deeply in love with classical music.
It was your grandmother who taught you?
Yeah. So we had weekly piano lessons. We had practiced 2 hours a day. Like when everybody was having fun, I was at a timer crying. And my mom's like, it's not starting until you start. Like, and I'm like, And now I love them for it, you know?
Do you play regularly?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Is it therapeutic for you?
Yeah. And I think music has always been my number one passion, you know, more so than drawing and stuff. So it's always been my dear friend, you know, growing up. So,
who are your musical influences?
In the classical world?
In any world.
I mean, I love...
You play classical.
I play classical, so I read music, but I write music now, too. So I can, you know, I've stemmed away from, like, Chopin and Beethoven, who's my favorite, and Mozart and stuff like that. But, yeah, I think modern-day stuff, it's, like, goes all across. You know, I love everything from my husband's music to, you know... I love a lot of 80s stuff, so the Depeche Mode and The Cure and, you know, romantic... hopeless romantic music I love.
Do you play other instruments besides piano?
Yeah, I play string instruments, so I can play guitar and things like that. I have harpsichords and organs, but technically it's piano. I collect a lot of obscure instruments, so our house has like a funny music room. Whenever you come over, you'll see.
Definitely, I can't wait.
Yeah, so
I can play by ear.
Cool.
I'm a little ADD, so lessons were horrible for
me. Yeah, yeah.
Because as soon as I knew what something was supposed to sound like, I couldn't look at the notes. They drove me nuts.
Yeah.
So I can play by ear, but the downside of playing by ear is if you don't do it all the time, you can only play what you can remember.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So oddly enough, I play Pachelbel's Canon.
Oh, cool. Nice.
Usually if you play one song, it's like Chopsticks or Mary Had a Little Lamb. On Pachelbel's Canon.
Nice.
On piano and on guitar, it's Paradise City.
Oh, cool. Nice.
Yeah.
Good range.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Kim. And so I want to see your obscure instruments. I can probably learn one song on each.
Cool. I love that.
Great. And also, you have a really beautiful singing voice.
Oh, thank you.
Did you take lessons for singing, or is that just...
I did. When I decided to write an album, I just like anything else, I was like, you know, in order to master something, I don't believe in naturals, to be honest. I don't, like, people are like, oh, wow, you have like a God-given gift of drawing, and I don't believe I do at all. I think what I do is not extraordinary in any sense. I think anybody can do what we do, you just have to put in the effort and the practice, you know?
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work, yeah. And so with the singing stuff, I just saw it again as like another muscle I needed to train. And, you know, I found like a voice coach that I really loved. And I was doing vocal lessons with him for 6 days a week for the first year or two until I started recording. And then until I felt like I was in control of my voice. And but, you know, we're constantly always continuing to learn, you know. I'm not like in any way, like I have yet to impress myself, you know, which is a good goal to have.
Well, you've already impressed me. But,
thanks.
And me, baby.
So sweet.
All right, tattoos. They're a part of your life. When did you get started with tattoos?
I started getting and doing tattoos at the age of 14.
What was your first one that you got?
I got an Old English J on my ankle for my first love. His name was James. And now I just tell people it stands for just kidding.
That's what she told me.
But I still have the tattoo. I love it because it was really such a pivotal time in my life. You know, I just was like, I don't know where I learned this, where I somehow picked up on the idea of freedom and just understanding that, you know, we stand accountable for our actions and like you don't necessarily have to do what people are expecting of you, especially society. And, you know, and for me, it was different than a lot of people. I don't condone people dropping out of school or anything like that. But for me, that was something that I quickly understood high school as like a social structure. You know, it was like, okay, this is training for what's going to be afterwards as an adult. You know, like the school stuff is easy for me. That's the fun part. I was like, learning is nothing, but it's the dealing with these dynamics, you know, of like who's cool based on what. And I just always just saw past that. So when I started tattooing, I was like, I need to focus more of my energy on this. And I left school and became a full-time tattoo artist. And
How old were you?
I was, I dropped out of school when I was 14. So I went to maybe 2 weeks of my freshman year.
Wow.
And then...
it's like the first bite of the apple.
Yeah. My poor parents, see?
Did they freak out at 14 when you dropped out of school?
Yeah. And I think for them, they were really scared, mainly by how I looked, to be honest. You know, I had... a shaved head, like I had like a mohawk and colored hair, and I was wearing like crazy just over the top makeup that, you know, I was wearing like eyeliner for lipstick and just dressing. And I don't want to say rebellious because I wasn't rebellious, but I was expressing something within me that I was evoked by music. Listening to a lot of punk rock music was like my gateway access into free thinking. And, you know, it taught me to question authority and like question like, why do we dress the way we do? Is it because that's what mom dressed me to be, or that's what's expected? Or is that what the popular girls are wearing? Like, if I were to ask myself, what do I actually like? It would look a lot different than most people, you know? And I don't know where I learned it, but I was okay with that. So from the very beginning, I never felt like I belonged, not even within my own family unit. And it was a bit of a lonely place, but then you found other like-minded people and it was like kindred spirits. So I quickly like found my tribe, you know, like through music, really. I mean, that's how we met too, through that connection and being an outsider. So I think that's something that I've always been pretty vocal about. And I don't attribute my success to it, but I attribute like a lot of relatability to
Well, it's
to
pretty
that.
Awesome to be able to look inside and say, who am I? What do I want?
Yeah.
And then just do it even when the outside forces don't want you to.
Yeah,
at 14.
Yeah.
At 14.
Yeah.
That's bananas.
Like, I'm 44 and I'm thinking, I'd like
trying.
To try that sometime. I need a J.
Well, it's crazy though because, you know, I look back and I'm like, you know, I have like a makeup line now and like we have these photo shoots where like they're taking pictures of me and I'm like, and I suck at it. I mean, I'm better off taking goofy photos or like bad posture and stuff, but I can do it. I just don't, it's not really my thing, but I trip out because it's like all my life I've just been accustomed to not being considered attractive in ways like to the like conventional idea of beauty. Like I've always been like obscure and weird or like, I don't know, like I don't want to say picked on because that sounds dramatic, but like I got made fun of a lot in school, you know, which I was like, yeah, I don't care or whatever, you know, I don't want to be in your fucking cheerleading squad anyway or whatever. but yeah, so I'm just so used to it now. It's like we're in real amazing times because, you know, having a blue lipstick, that would have not flown at all when I was growing up. You know, I was wearing eyeliner as lipstick. Now you see it on like fashion runways and you see like young kids wearing it and people are expressing themselves the same way that I was when I was little, except now they have each other. And, you know, that's a beautiful thing. I think it's an exciting
and,
time.
Yeah, and even if they're not geographically close, they can bond together and form groups. And
totally.
Have support.
Yeah.
How did you, like, stand out? There's so many tattoo artists. How did you rise to the top or stand out from the crowd?
Well, let's see. I was tattooing before the TV shows were popular and stuff, so there were not very many female tattooers. I couldn't remember like the handful of names of at the time that were good. And other than that, it's very much a male, like a man, manly man's world, you know. And so I don't know. I just knew that I had to practice and really be great, like my maximum potential. And
do you practice on people or do you practice
on paper?
Well,
I was lucky enough to have a lot of underage friends that were down to get tattooed because they couldn't get tattooed at shops. So I'm like, all right, cool, you know. You know, I just started off doing simple things and building up, you know. And so I didn't start doing portraits and realism until I was about 18 or 19 years old. And that was my true passion. It's like, I love realism. I love tattooing. You know, renditions of whether it's a photograph or someone's like pets or whatever. And really that's when I started connecting with my clients because it was, you know, you're tattooing portraits of people who passed away and things like that, like that really connect you with people. Like it's no longer about the tattoo, you know? So I think that's kind of how it happened.
Do you have favorite and least favorite tattoos on you?
Oh, on me? I like all my tattoos, even the crappy ones, because I had like my mom tattoo me, who is not a tattooer at all. And it looks like a drunk 3-year-old did it. And I love it because it's my mom.
A drunk 3-year-old. Yeah. 3-year-old wasn't good enough. You know. It's a drunk 3-year-old.
Yeah. Well, you know, 3-year-olds, sober ones, they might be pretty good. So, yeah. I think they're landmarks in time, you know, and I think that, you know, I have like exes' names and stuff like that, that I don't necessarily, they're not my favorite tattoos, but I don't look at them and go, oh, that guy cheated on me too many times. You know, I think about like the time when I got him and it was nice. And it was, there's a lot of learning that happened. And
how many times is too many times?
I said 20 times.
Oh, 20. I thought you said that guy cheated on me too many times.
Oh, one time is too many.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, good standard.
Yeah.
17.
Yeah.
Okay. Television, is that what kind of boosted you into a household name?
I don't know. I assume so. Yeah, I think that was kind of like the platform that ended up reaching the masses, you know. And then from there, I built my own little empire, you know. But I don't really like to give television credit because I was already super happy and successful prior to that.
But in terms of recognizability, right? I mean, you have a very unique look, but also...
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean...
I always wonder what it's like to go from sleeping on a floor in a small town in Mexico to becoming recognized in public. Is that a difficult transition?
I assume it would be for a lot of people. For me, I don't have that many friends. The friends I do have is a small amount, but they're really close friends and or my family. And like I've really been pretty vigilant about like keeping my circle those types of people. I think that it can be very easy to surround yourself with yes men or people who are hanging out for the wrong reasons. And I think that can be quite toxic, you know, and it could be a tough transition. But I think if you're surrounded by people that genuinely care about you for who you are, not for stupid TV shows or money or any of like that stuff, then it makes it pretty easy, you know?
Do you miss being anonymous ever? Is it ever I just want to be...
I don't know. I've had stars tattooed on my face like since I was like 17 now. So I feel like, I was always getting treated in interesting ways anyway.
You're always noticeable.
You blend into the crowd. Yeah, which is weird because I don't... somebody on Instagram the other day commented, like, why are you covering up so much? Is it because you're pregnant? And I'm like, no, I tattoos are an intimate thing for me, which is funny because they're quite external, right? Like, people see you and they're like, oh, like, it's a good conversation starter. But for me, it's more like, oh, I got this for myself, you know, and if I want to talk to you about it, that's cool. But I'm not into people grabbing my arms and wanting to, like, you know, have that sense of entitlement, you know?
People do that?
They used to. I mean, we don't get out of the house much anymore,
yeah.
But,
yeah. Yeah, but people do.
Yeah.
People
yeah.
do.
I bet
yeah.
you do too, because you have tattoos all over your head.
People touch me, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which is gross.
Yeah.
I can only imagine.
Yeah.
You need a tattoo right here that says,
don't touch
her.
Me.
Yeah.
That's right.
Well,
don't, hands off.
And I assume probably too, like when you have your baby, like I would get so freaked out.
I have like my ninja hands up so quick.
Right?
They're always trying to touch your belly.
Why do they do that?
Entitlement.
It's weird, ignorance. Right?
It doesn't make any sense. It should go the other way. If you're pregnant, it should be like that normal 4 feet.
Yeah.
Should now be 6 or 8 feet. But somehow yeah. it's like, let me just touch or,
yeah.
or
like if
or
I were to
comment.
Touch like my friend's belly, like just period, like
oh, wow.
it would be weird.
Yeah.
Like,
weird.
So a total stranger who happens to be pregnant,
yeah.
you would think even weirder.
Yeah.
No, but it's
somehow.
Like counterintuitive.
Yeah, yeah.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike, Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby. Not even diaper rash. You mentioned briefly that you have a beauty line with Sephora.
Yeah.
I was just there, my,
yeah.
my niece's bat mitzvah.
Getting some makeup for myself.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Getting some makeup for myself. Yeah. I like the underage red for me personally.
Yeah.
It makes me brings me back to my youth. But it's an insanely popular line. What's
yeah.
different about your beauty line?
Well, I think the beauty industry is always changing. So, you know, I think even as we speak, it's changing. So it's like 10 years ago when I first started the makeup line, there wasn't as many as there are now. And now everybody has a makeup line, which is cool.
I don't have a makeup line.
I don't either.
Yeah.
We need to get on.
I'm just saying there's like a lot of
brands.
I didn't mean it like that.
There's but, so many.
Yeah. And so I think when I first got into it, it was different because, you know, like I said, I came
pioneer,
from
a, baby. You're
thank
a pioneer.
You, thank you. But I think I come at everything I do as like from the standpoint of a fan. And I think a lot of companies, especially corporations, don't do that because they've like blocked out that childhood innocence somehow, you know, where they just like, okay, let's look at numbers and what sells and like marketing and blah, blah, blah. And then they bust out a product based on a formula, you know? Whereas for me, I'm just like, I'm a true fan of makeup. I'm a true fan of music. I'm a fan of tattooing and art. So my approach will always be like from the things that I want to make. So I think that there's a sincerity in that, you know, so I'm not trying to make a product to like sell to somebody to like convince them that they need this. Like nobody needs makeup, you know, but if you want to express yourself in that and you want some tools, here's some really cool, great stuff.
So your line is based on the makeup that you would already wear?
Kind of. I don't want to say that because I don't want people, it's not like the makeup line is about looking like me, you know,
right.
Like my mom wears my makeup and she does not dress like me at all. So it's, you know, there's the beautiful duality in that, but yeah. And I think over the years, you know, I really started getting more active into my animal rights activism. And so there's just in the beauty world, especially, there's so much like terrible cruelty with like animal testing and things like that. So we were kind of one of the pioneers of just being really vocal and beating on like the vegan drum, like loudly as possible and getting people to consume in a more conscious way. So
in terms of making your makeup vegan, mm-hmm. is it? Are there animal products in makeup or just
oh my god,
the,
yeah. I had no idea. When I first started, I was like, I didn't know what Carmine is like crushed beetles wings that people put on their lips.
Oh,
I'm like,
wow.
Yeah.
For dyes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lanolin is like comes from, there's some that comes from fats from animals and things like that.
Collagen.
Fish scales, stuff like that. But,
wow, I had no idea.
even more so than that, it's the animal cruelty aspect of it. So when you say like cruelty free, it means you don't test on animals, and the testing is just horrific what they do. And then I just think in the name of vanity, that's just so ridiculous.
Right, the first time I read that, I'm like, why would they put like lipstick on a pig and things like that? But you're saying the ingredients that you test how they react to.
Oh no! They like will make rabbits eat lipstick until they die. Like those, that's one of the tests, for example. Another one is like they'll inject certain chemicals into the eyeballs, or cut open bunnies and like insert ingredients. So it's like awful things like that.
That you never see. So like you just test out a lipstick and it's like, oh, this is a nice color.
Yeah, I mean, how many more things to, every time something new comes out, they have to test it again. So,
but how do you test for safety? I mean, I assume they're doing safety tests for humans.
Well, there's things that have already been approved, so it's like,
so you just use that.
Yeah, and also too, I think it's like the main thing about it is that it's a really huge industry in China, and so in order to sell in China, which is really big numbers, companies will say, okay, well, we'll test in order to sell in China. So it's, they're choosing money over, you know, being able to say, hey, let's not sell in China, and we'll just continue to be cruelty free. Yeah. So, but on the other hand, there's so many great brands that are totally coming on board with that too. So we're not alone on that. So it's nice.
I have a million more questions for you, but I want to get to Papa Bear. You've been sober for many years. What are you sober from?
Let's see. I just celebrated 11 years in July. July 7th is sober anniversary.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yay.
Happy anniversary is what do people say?
I think sometimes like in America they say birthday, but I think that sounds weirdly like juvenile, like happy birthday. Like,
but let's have a cake.
But to be honest, I celebrate my sober anniversary much more than I do my birthday. Like, it means a lot more to me, because without my sobriety, I wouldn't be sitting here with you today, or you know, have an amazing relationship or a baby on the way. So, but yeah, it was mainly drinking. I had like a 3-month stint of drugs. Thank you. But then I just decided to quit one day, and I haven't looked back. So, yeah.
Oh, there was no method or process?
Well, I mean, you know, a lot of people will take like the AA route. I read the book, like the big book, which I loved. But I think for me, I'm a lone wolf in ways, especially therapy-wise. I love one-on-one stuff versus like group therapy. And to me, it works a lot better. And unfortunately, like my experience with some of the AA, and I don't want to bash AA in any way, but you know, Alcoholics Anonymous is supposed to be emphasis on the anonymous part, you know, but now with social media, it's just nothing's anonymous. And you know, I really struggled with that, because I think becoming sober is like tough enough, let alone to have like people weigh in on that. Is it's a hard journey. So for me, it was a lot easier just to do it on my own. And I went through therapy and like read a lot of wisdom books and things. But the main thing was just filtering out like the friends that didn't really serve me in a positive way. So, which can be hard sometimes.
Seems hard, but healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you, I mean, 11 years later, mm-hmm. is it still challenging or?
Oh, no. I couldn't.
Totally in the past.
Yeah. I mean, you could do drugs and drink in front of me and I wouldn't be tempted at all. I just choose not to hang out with people that do drugs, you know. Drinking doesn't bother
me as much.
Drinking
happens all over, so it's hard to get away from it.
Kind of. I don't know. I have a lot of sober friends. I mean, my husband also sober. And
there's all those 3-year-old drunkards doing tattoos.
Yeah. Gotta stay away from that.
They're such bad influences, too.
All right. Rafael, you were born in Mexico.
Yes, Dr. Berlin, I was.
Tell me about your early beginning.
Oh, early beginning. Let's see. I was born in Mexico, Cotija, Michoacán, and my father left my mother and myself in Mexico behind so that he can come to the United States to pursue a better life for us. So he came.
Well, how old were you when that happened?
Very young. I was probably like 1.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I didn't see my father until I was 4 years old when he sent for us. So he got himself established. Once he got established, then we came over, my mother and I, I was in the trunk of a car, you know, so I was smuggled in.
Sneak over.
Yeah. I was smuggled in. And I was raised in San Diego, California. I went to school there. I went to Pacific Beach Elementary and dropped out of high school. I opened up a...
Oh, yeah.
We're living parallel
like
lives here.
Yeah, I dropped out of high school really, really young, and I opened up a restaurant when I was 18 years old, the first vegetarian restaurant in San Diego. This was back in 91, 92, very
Well, it's not only young to drop out of high school, but to start a business and a food business, a restaurant business, which can be pretty challenging.
And support his whole family, yeah.
Yeah, I...
Where do you even get the know-how to do that?
I started working really young. My father used to take me with him to... wherever he worked, whatever restaurant he worked at, he would find a way to get me in there. And after school, I would go and work. So I started washing dishes and I started prepping. And then by the time I was 17, because I opened up the restaurant at 18, by the time I was 16, I did a mentorship at the place that I was working at, Ole Madrid, with this chef that had all these awards. He was like a big name in that world of culinary arts. And he taught me everything I knew at a really young age. And I actually ran a five-star restaurant at a really young age. So then I wanted to do it for myself. I mean, the story is a little darker than that, what led me to running a restaurant by myself. But, you know, not to dive in deep, I basically said, hey, you know what, I'm gonna do this on my own. And I did, you know, for the restaurant's still there. It's been running for like 22 or 23
what?
Years.
Yeah.
I gave it to my brother. I want to say.
Yeah, all three of your brothers work there, right?
Yeah, I gave it to my brother like 6 years ago. I got myself in some trouble. My father and I were really close, but we used to bump heads a lot. So for the
are you similar to each other?
No,
not at all. Okay. Not at all.
So it wasn't that bumping
but
heads.
My father.
Well, you know what? You have to understand.
It's a soft spot for me.
Yeah,
to talk about my father, I will start crying.
It's okay, but I think what should be noted is that, you know, and especially in Mexican culture, and this is obviously very generalizing. It's not in every family dynamic, but. In Latin culture too, it's always like the eldest is kind of bestowed this responsibility of overlooking for the family, you know?
Yeah.
So like if the father passes away, it kind of, you know, goes down to whoever the next kid is. And, you know, you were the
I am the oldest.
You're the oldest.
Yeah, I am.
And so when his father passed away, you know, it was like,
I stepped up.
Yeah. Which is a lot, you know, to take on when you're that young. And interestingly enough, I know we're not talking about the pregnancy yet, but like, but for us to us to be going through this journey together now has been really amazing, because it's helped us like reflect a lot on our own childhood and our own like parents and how they raised us. And I mean, I'm sure that just happens naturally, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And
I think that's a really good thing.
It's beautiful, right?
Yeah, some healing.
Process.
Yeah.
Exactly.
A lot of healing.
Sets you up. Mm-hmm.
Something I'm looking forward to. You know, I have a daughter. I have my daughter's 24 years old now.
Oh, wow.
And I had her when I was really young. I was
17 years old.
17.
But this is such a different experience now.
Yeah, and I didn't get to be like a parent, you know. Not only was I really young, but I was running this restaurant that I was working at, you know, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. So, I mean, I was a provider, but I wasn't.
But you're also 17, you know?
Yeah. So
it's really mind-blowing. Like, I look at teenagers today.
I know.
It's like I can't even get them to like put their laundry in the hamper.
I'm excited. I'm excited for our pregnancy.
Yeah.
And to be able to do it differently, you know, to be there and not have to worry about, oh, man, I have to be at work, you know, because we're now, you know, financially and stable and
also
and
mentally
older,
too
and
it's
mentally,
different
it's a whole different world.
Yeah.
Are you still connected to your daughter?
Yeah, we are. I mean, we've had a small falling out, you know, and we're trying to mend those wounds, but yeah, you know, I love my daughter and we were extremely close for a long time, and then we had a falling out, and it's been rough, you know. It's been rough, but we're trying to work things out, you know.
You wrote a book. So,
yes.
and tell me what the book is about.
You know, the book is,
how old were you when you wrote the book?
It wasn't
that long ago?
It was like 2 weeks ago.
No. The book, I want to say same, maybe like 5 or 6 years ago.
Okay. Living Dangerously.
Oh, actually, no, I think maybe 8. I think I wrote it in like 2010. I had just gotten out of jail. And I wrote that book in jail. It was more of a practice. You see, when I was young, I saw a lot of therapists, and there was a lot of exercises that they taught me, because I was really angry when I was young. I was kind of, for lots of different reasons, I mean, not to get too in depth, but I had some issues. I kind of come from a dysfunctional family and whatnot, but a lot of it had to do with the environment and me also being from somewhere else and trying to adapt, you know, to this whole new world. And I think I was
being from Mexico and trying to adapt to San Diego.
Exactly. And I think a lot of it was rough. And then until acclimated, once I acclimated, certain things were already set in me, you know, already had my personality set in stone. And I because of it, you know, I got in a lot of trouble when I was young. And even, you know, I balanced it out. I did a lot of good things, but I also got in a lot of trouble, you know. So I did things for my family to make them proud, but also did a lot of things that were the opposite. So,
Living Dangerously.
The book.
Is the book.
Yeah, so I ended up in jail. And again, this book was just a practice from things that I learned in therapy, which was just kind of writing. It was like self-exploration, you know, and just trying to go back inside yourself. And I was trying to figure out what had led me into jail. I was like, because I really didn't even know how I ended up in jail, because during that time I was drinking and I was very upset at myself, and I was trying to punish myself because my father passed away, and I blamed myself for his death because we got in a really, really ugly fight the day that he passed away. I unraveled. You see, before that, I was my father's nurse. I took care of my father for 4 years, and the restaurant was established, so I was making great money. So I didn't really have to work. The restaurant was running itself. My father was in a nursing home, and he didn't want to be there. He wanted to be home. He was like, hey, if I'm going to die, I want to die in my house. But he was kind of blacklisted from the nursing communities because he had a bad attitude, you know, and he would do things that people would quit all the time. So we put him in a nursing home. Same things were happening there. And he just wanted to come home. So I said, hey, you know what? I took it upon myself because we had this relationship where I was always chasing him always wanted him to acknowledge me in a certain way. So I think maybe that's why, one of the reasons I like opened up the restaurant really early and did all these kind of things, you know. But I think in a certain way, they were doing the opposite, you know.
But the book was a really good way for you to be able to like...
Yeah, long story short, the book was me just trying to make sense of why I ended up in jail.
So it was more for yourself.
Yeah, everything I've done, the music, everything that I do has always been about just self-exploration and self-awareness. It's always been about me trying to have this relationship with myself.
But growing up, you also were in part of a gang.
Yes. I got jumped into a gang. Okay, so this all it all ties into my father, the book, the jail. I got jumped into a gang when I was 13 years old.
Oh, wow.
How
does that happen?
Well, I didn't want to be in a gang. It wasn't something that I was like aiming at, or I was actually, I was really good at school and whatnot, and I was an artist. I wanted to be an artist.
But a lot of that is just your surroundings. You know?
It was my environment. Yeah. So,
we can't really blame it on...
I'm not blaming it on anyone. I'm just so sorry if that's how I portrayed it. But it has nothing to do with my... Okay. So I have to tell the story. My father got in a fight with some... defending my sister, my youngest sister, from some guys that were... that are in the gang that I got jumped into, that I'm from, the gang that I'm from. So this was before I got into the gang. So my father defended my little sister, and he beat these two guys up. And I saw it. I witnessed it. It was my first time ever seeing my father fight. So now I'm going to school, and in school I'm hearing rumors and talk. People are talking about the incident that my dad was in. You know, my father defended my sister and whatnot, and he beat these two guys up. And some of the guys that I'm in school with, Their older brothers are in this gang that I'm now in, or that I've been in since I was 13. But, you know, just I'm no longer like an active gang member, so I'm not like a gang member. I'm like 43 years old. I don't, you know, that was a long time ago, but I didn't necessarily like, get jumped out or anything like that. I just moved on, you know. I'm just living my life. I'm married. So the word on the streets is that they're going to hurt my father. So
it was a rival gang?
The gang that I'm from are saying that they're... Excuse me, because it's a sensitive subject for me, so
yeah,
sometimes it's hard for me to form sentences when I become emotional. But... So a friend of mine, he's from the gang, his brother's from the gang, and he's the one that told me, hey, you know, my brother and the friends are saying they're going to harm your dad. And I said, please talk to your brother for me and ask him if there's anything I can do for them to leave my father alone. He does. The next day in school, he approaches me and he says, hey, I spoke to my brother and they said that the only way that they'll leave your father alone is if you join the gang. So that very day, when I got off school, I went to where, you know, I went to where they all hang out, and I got jumped in.
Mm.
And I joined a gang because I thought it would keep people from hurting my father.
Holy cow.
And then after that, I just learned the ins and outs, and I did what, you know, I became a gang member, and then, you know, and then I was always in, you know, I like to say in certain interviews when people ask me, because, you know, the music that I make, because my life has really been like a kaleidoscope, you know, so many different shapes and colors of, so I'm grateful for it, you know, but I really feel that I've lived and I am living multiple realities simultaneously, you know.
So I hear that. That makes sense.
So I know that people are like, man, you're almost like, I've been described as an enigma, because it's like, wait, you make this type of music that's electronic and it's gothy, but then you were in a gang and then you opened up a restaurant, a vegetarian restaurant at that, at the age of 17. Yeah, I've experienced a cornucopia or a plethora of just different types of experiences, you know. I'm grateful for all of them because they've really made me who I am, you know.
When did you start getting tattoos?
Well, when I got jumped into a gang,
away.
I got my first gang tattoo on my back,
so
which is Sherman.
Also, like around 14-ish.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Parallel here.
Yeah.
Living parallel lives.
Yeah. Yeah, parallel lives with my wife.
And you have a bunch of them. I asked Kappa, do you have a favorite or a least favorite?
Yeah, my wife's name. You know, I have her name on my cheek here.
On your face.
Yeah,
you
my face.
That was a birthday
Catherine.
Present.
Yeah.
For you?
Did you do it?
No. I would not be so vain. I'm like, I know where I want to put my name on your face right here. I was actually in Europe on tour with IMX, and then I was coming back like the day before my birthday, and you were going to pick me up from the airport, and then he showed up and I had it. Yeah, it was the sweetest
thing. Yeah, and I didn't want to tattoo my face because, you know, that's how I pay my bills. But I went for it.
Is there, just out of curiosity, is there any part of the body you can't tattoo?
Well, I mean, there's parts that are they're more resilient to the pigment. So, you know, like the bottoms of your feet or your palms of your hand. I mean, I have my hand tattooed, but it's quite crude. You can't get very detailed just because it's just more callousy. So, so there's parts like that. But, for the most part.
You can tattoo on it because I've seen the inside.
Yeah.
What about mucous membranes?
Like I have the inside of
vulva,
my
eyelid.
My eyelid on my eyelid, not inside the eyelid. But I don't know. I think, as a tattooer for me, I'd personally just like whenever I'm doing a tattoo, it's like asking yourself like to make sure the person's not going to regret it, you know? So I think there's some ideas oftentimes like sound like a good idea and can easily backfire too. So I'd rather go to sleep at night feeling good 100% that everybody I tattoo is going to be happy versus like taking a chance on
stuff. Do people put them on like private spots?
I don't have it.
I don't either.
She's like, I do.
Oh, I forget when I put on deodorant. It's but have you done them to people?
I have. I mean, I've tattooed people in their private areas. Yeah.
Men and women, both?
Yeah, but you know, it's not like, I think it's like, it, before it'd be like a very macho thing, like, yeah, I want to get a tattoo on my dick, you know? And it's like, sure, man, like everybody says that, but then when it's time to do it, it's like, you know, that's just, can you imagine the sensitivity and just how?
Yeah, I can't even imagine it on my arm.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
Exactly. Is there a most sensitive place where you've gotten tattoos?
I think it's, I mean, you know what? This would actually be,
because you have them on your head, which also looks pretty.
Yeah, you actually would be a master at knowing this stuff, because it's really about nerve endings more than actual like fatty tissue. So a lot of people think, oh, I'll get my butt tattooed because there's a lot of fat and cushion there. But a lot of your nerves are
close together.
Totally. So it's actually one of the more sensitive places.
Mm, interesting.
So it's more based upon your nerves versus like your, you know, muscle or fatty tissues. So.
How much is in the way?
Yeah.
We are going to take a quick commercial break. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. I want to get back to your music, right? How did your right now you have a band, Prayers.
Yes.
And it's been described as Cholo Goth.
Yes,
which
Cholo
seem
Goth.
Like genre. Very separate worlds coming together. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah, you're a pioneer, baby.
I'm a pioneer.
Look at that. Another parallel.
Pioneers. Yeah. Same thing, you know. I just, how can I say? I went to a white school. And then I grew up in a Mexican neighborhood. I combined
smush
the
them
two.
Together.
Yeah,
yeah.
So that's what happened.
Yeah.
But same thing, you know, I really wasn't even, I've always wanted to do music, but I never had the opportunity. I was always working. And even when, again, you know, same thing. It came from my dad. I was in jail. I wrote this book in jail, my dad came to me in a dream. It was as real as this conversation that we're having here. And he shook me up. You know, he came to me. He said he loved me, that he forgave me, and that he wanted me to start living for myself and not for our family or for anyone else. And he really wanted me to start, you know, to do what's inside my heart, whatever my heart desires to go for it. So when I got out of jail, I taught myself. I got out of jail, locked. I own a home. I own, you know, I have a home. And instead of moving into my home, I rented it out and I moved into my garage, locked myself away for a whole year. Right when I got out of jail, I didn't want to be around people. Kind of same thing. I just
needed to adjust.
I needed to adjust. Thank you.
That's what I do.
So I locked myself away. I rented the house to my brother and I stayed in the garage for a year. And I watched a bunch of YouTube channels on how to produce and play instruments, and I taught myself, and that's it. Now
that's
we're
impressive.
Here.
That's badass.
How long were you in jail for?
Not that long, 6 months.
That's a long time.
It seems like a long time.
I mean, that's like where we're at, 6 months pregnant right now.
No, but I needed it. You know, it was a good thing. I'm not going to say anything bad about it. It really helped me. In so many ways.
It's been a big part of like your rehabilitation.
Yeah,
like,
I was very self-destructive. Yeah. I was punishing myself. You know,
was
like
the system putting you in there just?
No.
Okay. No, not at all.
But it turned out to be a good thing
for
you.
Yeah, I just make the best of any situations. And when I was in there, I'm a creative. I've always been. And I'll take any opportunity to create. And I was like, okay, I'm in here 6 months. I'm going to write a book. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, okay. I was, like I said, the restaurant was doing well. So when I got out, I was like, hey, I'm just going to stay in this garage. I don't need anything. I don't need to go to work. I'm just
you know, that's
sit here.
One of the things that honestly we connected through is just, you know, we both have like exteriors that I think can be very intimidating, or they give off an impression of, you know, hardness, I think. I don't know how else to describe that. But one of the things I love about Raphael, which a lot of people don't know, is like, you know, they hear his music and they hear the lyrics and it's aggressive. And I love it. It's amazing. It evokes a lot of feelings for me, too. But one of the things that, you know, we really connected over was just his gentle heart. You know, he has a very gentle demeanor. There's so much love in there. And I think for somebody who's gone through so much exposure to violence and just a pretty unforgiving, volatile upbringing, like it's just so amazing and inspiring to, you know, see you on the other side of that. And That's the Raphael that that I fell in love with, and you can't have one without the other. You know,
it's so hard to picture because you're such a gentle soul.
Right,
I am. Thank you.
I mean, you're a warm, gentle soul. You're passionate. You're loving, and you're calm. And so this whole history, it's almost like
shocking, right?
Yeah, it's shocking. It's like you must be talking about somebody else.
Yeah.
Well, it feels like you've lived a few lives.
Yeah.
No wonder why you married a cat. Yeah, it makes sense. You got a bunch of lives here.
How did you two meet? How did you find each other?
What's funny enough is we met 14 years ago.
Yes.
I don't remember because this is back in my drinking days. So, you know, as embarrassed as I wish I could be, I don't remember how I behaved. And I asked him, hey, was I nice at least? Was I a nice person? He's like, you were amazing, whatever.
Yeah.
And, but I guess it's another reminder of like how grateful I am for my sobriety because I really wish I could remember every single moment that I've ever shared with Raphael, you know, and especially back then how interesting would it have been to like, oh my God. But instead we reconnected about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
And he came over to the house because he had wanted me to collaborate on a music video for one of his songs. And I'm usually like not into doing music videos. So I'm like, okay, they're either going to cast me as a vampire or a biker chick or a drug dealer. Yeah. So I'm like, no thanks. But then, you know, he shows up with this really refreshing, beautifully artful minded treatment for a video. And I'm like, who is this guy? He's like everything that I love, you know, like I'm kind of the same, come from the same world where it's like, I look white, but you know, I'm Latina and I've never been accepted in both worlds, you know? So I've always felt like a lack of belonging. And then this guy's like a mirror in like the most beautiful way ever, you know? And so we reconnected. At the time I was celibate. So it was like, you know, instantly friend zoned. And I assumed he had like this beautiful, like, Aztec warrior goddess girlfriend or something. And then but come to find he had a crush on me the whole time.
Oh, that's really
and you
sweet.
Can finish the story from that point on.
Yeah. That was pretty much it.
The story's still unfolding, exactly. I just want to ask you a couple more questions. We'll take a little break. Is there a message, overall message behind prayers and your music?
Yeah, I mean it's about it. Definitely about empowerment, I think, you know, like, and this might sound ridiculous, but it's like empowerment through vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
you know, if that makes any sense. And people have questioned that. They're like, empowerment through vulnerability makes no sense. But yeah, I mean, that
makes sense to me.
That's where it all comes from. A lot of the music and the art, again, it's just about self-exploration and self-awareness. But it's dialogue that I'm having with those that have hurt me, and I know that I can't be in the same room with them. So if I can just express it through my music, then it works for me because that's even easier, you know, and better because then I can really say what I need to say. But it's all if you really listen to the music, like the Young Gods album, that the majority of that album is about my daughter, you know, and how she hurt me. And it was just me trying to communicate to her, you know. So a lot of those are like, it's like therapy, me just trying to make sense.
I have so many albums that I need to make that, you know, are popping into my head right now. We should all make albums like that. And then also, in addition to your music, you are a painter and a sculptor.
Yeah, a lot of it comes from like the DIY culture, you know. I kind of grew up around that where you just do it yourself. So a lot of times I needed stuff for the restaurant, and so I would draw the menu or during the time that I was I wanted to be an artist, you know, but my father wanted me to and I don't even have the body for it, but he wanted me to be an athlete, and I tried it and it didn't work, but but I always wanted to be, I've been drawing since I was a kid, you know, that was my escape, and writing, that was my another escape of mine. But yeah, a lot of it came just from necessity, from things that I needed, and I was like, well, I'll just draw it. I mean, I got a scholarship in fashion design, You know, so I did competitions. I went to school for hypnosis when I got a jail right after jail also. So my first album, SD Kill Wave, is on the concept of NLP, of neuro-linguistic programming. So nice. A lot of it, I was like really just experimenting with language when I was, and a lot of it came because the one thing that helped me when I was young was hypnosis, you know? And I don't tell people this, like I know we're going through the hypno babies and hypno birthing and whatnot, but, you know, I went to school for hypnosis and I graduated as a hypnotherapist, but I didn't want to practice because it was more self-help because I wanted to control. I wanted to be able to control my own emotions. And I recalled when I first was introduced to it as a kid, it was the only thing that helped me with my temper. I had mastered already everything that I needed to get out of situations with therapists. I had already mastered the language and I knew, okay, you know, my probation officer needs this, so I'll go to the course and I'll learn and I was just kind of like maneuvering my way. I was just in order. So I wasn't really getting help. I was just like working the system. And then I got myself in a really bad situation where I hurt someone and in front of my mother at that, and it scared her. And she was like very resourceful lady, and she found help for me. And that's when I first got hypnotized, and we really got down to a lot of like the self-hate and the self, you know, the pain that I was carrying with me. And it helped me. It really did. Like it gave me a long fuse, the longest fuse ever. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until my father died that I unraveled. So all the work that I had done, when my father died, it was done. My father just made it all, you know, made me unravel. So then I went back into just being angry and self-punishment and self-hurting. And when I got out of jail, when I was writing that book, the book is cute. Only that book that I wrote is just a little small part of it that I wanted to share just for a whole different reason. I wanted to do something in my own way that was kind of like introducing certain people in my community into like reading and whatnot. So I did it in a certain way.
It's fiction, right? But it's like loosely based on
exactly
life experiences.
Yes. And that when I got out, I did the music and I went to school for hypnosis. Again, it was just so that I can control my own emotions, so that like I would be able to go back into the world and not let it, you know, destroy me in a sense, where I can have the tools that I need in order to just maneuver and get the things that I need in life.
I was sort of having like an OMG, like I want to be hypnotized by you.
So cool. I
feel
love
like
it.
You can draw the real crap that I've been trying to bury in there out.
And I love you guys.
Yeah, I know. Aren't
this
they
is so fun.
Lovable? Yeah. It's amazing. All right. I also want to know about your sobriety because you're also sober. Was that after prison as well?
Yeah, that was actually before. I knew I was getting ready to go. So as I was you know, they were like, you're going to have to turn yourself in a certain amount of time. I fought my case for like a year because they were trying to give me 7 years.
Oh, wow.
But luckily, you know, which is ridiculous for what I had done. You know what I mean? I threw a glass in a bar. I was in a bar and I threw a glass.
And it just landed on a person.
It hit the wrong person in the arm. And then they wanted to give me 7 years for that. Whoa. It was insane. But luckily, I had money, you know,
so you can get a good lawyer.
Yeah. If I didn't have the money, I would not know my wife. I'd just be getting out.
I feel like I wish I would have been around there because we would have gotten a different lawyer. I'm you ended up getting two felonies for that.
Yeah, for throwing a glass.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
I mean, it's not an excuse. It's not an excuse.
Is that two strikes?
That's two strikes.
So in California, we said we have a three strike rule. So if you have another
one
strike,
more,
that's life in prison?
Yeah, that's right.
Holy crap.
So that's the other reason why I actually dove deep into the hypnosis, because I really wanted to be able to like control myself to where the only thing that I did not dismantle inside of me, because I have a whole bunch of things that I embedded in myself, but the only thing that I left was life or death, you know what I mean? So if someone's trying to kill me, then I would defend myself. But other than that, words or even none of that, you know, and I've done a lot of work
more
on myself.
Like, meaning you got rid of those triggers, like those
potential
things that might set you off.
So many triggers,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and
he still road rages though.
He does.
She's telling on you now.
Wait a second, I remember you. Well, luckily, road
like,
rages.
He gets mad sometimes. I'm like, babe, who cares? Like, the guy was just going on the way over here.
I mean, you're very calm considering because what you did was throw a glass. Mm-hmm. It's not like.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's
and I would think if there was a three strikes rule, like if I got caught speeding three times, then they'd take my car away and I can never drive again. And I had already gotten caught speeding twice. I can't imagine how I would drive, like so nervous and delicate and tender. But this is like your life. One more just random thing, and
scary,
that could be life in prison.
Yeah. It's very scary.
Do you feel that pressure on a regular basis, or
no? Because you're such a. I mean, we're so square.
You're so mellow.
Yeah. We're a little vegan. Yeah, we're sober.
We like volunteer at farm sanctuary. We hang out indoors most of the time.
It's a whole new world.
Yeah.
All right. Tune in for part two of our conversation with Kat Von D and Rafael Reyes as we talk about their pregnancy, plans for labor and delivery, parenthood, and beyond on the Informed Pregnancy Podcast.
Doctor, doctor, give me the news. I got a whole lot of questions for you. Kids gonna test my will. I got a lot to learn and my baby's due.
This episode is sponsored by an innovative product that's made a big difference for parents and babies alike. Dr. Mom Butt Balm. As a parent of four, I've had my fair share of battles with diaper rash, often resorting to thick, unpleasant pastes. I only recently discovered Dr. Mom Butt Balm, and I was immediately impressed by its pleasant consistency and ease of application. This pediatric-approved skin protectant is free from dyes, preservatives, and zinc oxide, making it perfect for your baby's sensitive skin. It's designed by a doctor who's also a mom, ensuring your little one gets the gentlest care. A small dab is all it takes to soothe and protect, avoiding the mess and hassle of traditional treatments. With ingredients like dimethicone and petrolatum, Dr. Mom Butt Balm not only soothes, but also restores your baby's delicate skin. Available on Amazon.com and Walmart.com, it's the smart choice for every parent wanting to keep diaper rash at bay. Remember, with Dr. Mom Butt Balm, nothing comes between you and your baby. Not even diaper rash.